Hi, everyone. My name is Tim. Welcome to another episode of the All Out Coach Podcast. This is the place that gives you voice, character, and potential you need to stretch yourself and lift others. Today, I have a special guest. His name is Steve Hertz, and he's the president of IF Management, a talent management company that has worked with celebrities and well-known leaders in the sports, entertainment, and broadcasting industries. Today, Steve will tell us why we shouldn't take yes for an answer. Steve, I'm looking forward to our discussion. Welcome.
Tim, thank you. It's great to be here. Really excited. Thanks for having me.
What were some of your talents early on in your career?
It's a good question. I think that it was kind of a fluke, to be honest with you. I didn't even know. First, I graduated from college at University of Michigan, then went to law school at Vanderbilt, and then when I decided not to pursue law and decided to go into another field, I first thought it was going to be sports management, and eventually came to realize by working for this company called Athletes and Artists that sportscasters and newscasters, TV weathermen, all had agents, that those people had agents. I didn't even know at that point when I started in the industry in 1991, 92, that those people had agents. And so it was just a fluke to learn about this actually in my first job. A talent, I don't know if you want to call it a talent, but I think I kind of recognized early on to be reliable and diligent and someone who would be a problem solver for other people. And I remember going to the front desk of the office and telling this woman, Gail Lockhart, "Hey, Gail, if anybody calls the office and you don't know where to put that phone call, if you just don't know who to talk to, the person, just give it to me. I'll handle it for you." And she would call me and say, "Oh, I got this person on the phone. I don't know what to do with them. Will you talk to them?" And invariably a lot of times it was a waste of time, of course, but invariably one out of every three or four or five times, there was a really valuable person on the other side of the line with maybe some crazy idea, but often it turned into something. And one time this lawyer named Bob Rice called the office and he was looking to put together a chess program. And through that, I ended up helping Bruce Beck become the host of the American Chess Challenge on ESPN and briefly represented Garry Kasparov because of it, just because I said, "I'll take any phone call." So I don't know if that's a talent, but I think it was an insight that I had.
What was the premise behind the book, Don't Take Yes for an Answer? Why did you write the book?
I wrote the book because I feel that I've observed over these last 30 years a certain couple qualities that people that really had achieved a great deal of success in their lives and were able to reach their potential. And they had those consistent themes in those lives. And I also had observed over this time that certain people who may have worked hard and were earnest people and meant well and studied and did all seemingly all the right things, they didn't achieve nearly their potential. And so this book is really about those two qualities. One being, don't take yes for an answer. The idea is try to find yourself a constant feedback in your life and find what you can be doing better. Ask others, ask yourself, figure out a way to learn what it is you could be improving upon. Because as I talk about in the book, there's a lack of feedback in society now. We really don't get feedback, whether it's from often in our academic careers, you know, they have a lot of grade inflation, or even in companies that are afraid to tell you what you could do better because they don't want to get sued, or HR departments are wary of that. People don't even get fired anymore by and large. And the ultimate loser in all that is you, the person who doesn't know how to get better because there's nothing you think you could or should be doing better. And that's why I say, kind of look at all those yeses you're getting in your life and kind of discard them and realize that they don't mean that much. And try to find the no's out there. Where can you be improving? How can you be getting better? And how do you do that? And so that's the premise. And then the second part of the book is this idea about this thing called AWE, A-W-E, which is stands for authority, warmth, and energy. And it's basically just a shorthand hack, if you will, for the soft skills of life. You know, if you think about emotional intelligence or soft skills, how to, you know, communicate and convey to others that you have the authority about yourself stylistically, and you have that warmth, the ability to connect with someone and make people trust you, and you have a good energetic dynamic with others. And I think that if you have those two qualities and you also work hard and go to, you know, show up on time, then you will achieve a lot more closer to your potential than you otherwise would.
Now, you started studying law and you had a professor that had an important impact on your life, right?
Well, I've had several professors have an important impact on my life, but I don't know if you're talking about Professor Friedman, yes. Barry Friedman. So in my book, I talk about Professor Barry Friedman. He and another professor named Nick Zeppos, who ended up ascending to the head of Vanderbilt University, they were probably the two biggest impactful people on me academically. And the reason why is because they both taught these very, like, really arcane, what you would almost call really boring classes. One was civil procedure and the other was criminal constitutional law. And yet I signed up for every class each of them taught because they were so committed to their own message, so committed to the subject, so passionate about it, so energetic about it. And they transferred that excitement that they had, that enthusiasm, that passion to me and to everyone else in the class. And they were probably two of the most, if not the two, they were two of the most five most popular professors in the whole law school, because it wasn't just me who felt that kinetic energy from them. It was everybody in the classroom. And I just learned from them that you can create that energetic dynamic with another person if you try hard enough and you learn how to do it. And it can be very, very, very powerful tool for you and for them.
In that book, you mentioned that that professor, at one point, he actually got up on the table to grab everyone's attention, right? To create that energy.
He did. And he just, again, like, it wasn't so much about his energy. It was about how he made you feel sitting in that classroom, watching him modulate his energy, build it up to a crescendo, and then get you to participate and want to learn the material that he was explaining to you and want to dive in and explore it. And it's just like an incredibly intoxicating feeling to have that kind of an ability that he had. And when you see that, you want to try to replicate that for yourself in your own life in some way.
Your book is centered around the concept, the awe concept. And that awe is, the way you define it, is that authority, warmth, and energy. So let's maybe break that down one by one and start with authority. How do you build that authority?
Well, again, what I'm saying in this book is that you may have your substantive authority. You have your college degree, your law degree, your business degree, whatever it is. You got your job at place X or Y. So you have that substantive authority. This is about really an idea of a stylistic authority. How do you gain more influence in your life? How do you get customers, clients? How do you manage people in your organization, get them to respect you, get promoted, et cetera, all the things that, you know, people want in their career. And I think that emanates from the authority that you convey in yourself, in your persona. And so that would be the kind of things that go into that would be your voice, your body language, your own emotional commitment to your message, the sense of self-assuredness you have in the physicality of your body, the eye contact you make when you speak to someone, your own commitment to your message. Because if you don't do those things, you might be the most authoritative person in the world at whatever it is you do. But if you don't communicate it in your being, in your persona, then people are going to look at you and you're going to seem like you doubt yourself. You're not going to seem self-assured. And that's going to go to the issue of someone believing your competence. Are you someone I can trust to do the dental filling? Are you someone that I want to write my will if I need a lawyer? Are you someone that I want to listen to your podcast? If you're doubting your own self in the way you communicate, other people are going to smell that and feel that on you. And that's going to either help you sink or swim or soar if you can do it.
Yeah. I work in the pharmaceutical industry, as you know. I've been in the industry for about 16 years on the medical side. And this is the industry where they teach you about having executive presence, and they teach you about the kind of perception that you are to convey to others, right, to customers, so that they trust you. So when you have authority, when you build that presence, what do you get out of, what is the outcome?
Well, I mean, it can be a lot of things. It may be different in different situations, but I think that in terms of pharmaceuticals, for example, I think you have to have an internal belief both in yourself and in the product or whatever it is you're offering somebody else. And I don't like the word selling, because I prefer to say it's an exchange, right? If you have a drug that you think is going to cure XYZ disease for this doctor or this hospital, and it costs, you know, a dollar per pill, whatever it might be, you're not selling them anything. You're saying this is a fair deal here. And ultimately, you have to believe that in yourself. So I would say that, you know, this is kind of a little bit of a kitschy line, but you should think to yourself, I'm not selling, I'm just telling. I'm just telling you what I have here to offer. If you want it, great. I really believe it'll help you. And if you don't want it, that's okay too. You know, I can't make you do something you don't want to do. And the most important thing I think about really great salesmen are, is that they actually don't try to sell you anything. You got to make that decision yourself. So if you can communicate the excitement that you have about the product with that level of authority that you have, and the product is good, and you can explain it to them and teach them in a way, they're going to learn it and they're going to want it.
Yeah. I know that you have a lot of friends in the healthcare industry in general. And I know that you mentioned some of them in your book. Just so the people who are listening know, I'm currently working at a company that launched a new product during the COVID pandemic in April, which is not something that many pharmaceutical companies can say. And so it is for a very rare type of cancer, yet it has the potential to spare kidneys, and yet treat and eliminate that cancer. There was a urologist that you mentioned in the book that I think would be interesting for a lot of my friends and those in healthcare to know about, because he has a particular personality, I think.
Yeah, so the urologist that I mentioned is Dr. Michael Levine. He's a urologist in Lake Success, Long Island, and he was also a professor at North Shore Long Island Jewish Hospital up there in that same little area. And he's a surgeon and also a diagnostic urologist, and a guy I've been friends with since we're about 10 years old. Oh, really? And I've actually gone on rounds with him when he was a resident back at the VA hospital. I used to visit him, and he would, you know, when possible, take me around and just introduce me to the whole field. And I've been fascinated by it from the beginning. And when I interviewed him for the book, he explained that there's been a real change in medicine over these last 30 years. And what he explained is that the big change has been that in the early days, when you went to the doctor in 1991 or thereabouts, 1990, you know, the doctor had all the knowledge in the world. Like, you didn't have any knowledge. And now, when you go to the doctor, by the time you're going for the second visit, if not even before that, you've read up on your disease, you've gone to Google, you're the expert. You probably know more about the disease than the doctor does, because he's treating 100 diseases every day or week, and you've got the one. And, you know, and so he said, it's not about the delivery of medical care anymore. It's about the communication of the delivery of medical care. And it goes to the issue of these ideas that I talk about in this book, where, like, so much of your life becomes commoditized in your career, because, you know, if you had, God forbid, prostate cancer, you could go to 10 doctors who would tell you you have a tumor, it needs to be removed, or you need to go for radiation therapy, whatever it might be, or the great miracle drug that your company has now. But what is interesting is that he makes this point that people trust their doctor because of the physical interaction they have with them in the office. And he says, like, or in the hospital, he said, you know, when you talk to the patient, when you're doing rounds in the hospital, you never, ever point your toes away from the patient. You never put your hand on the door handle if you're walking out of the room with the patient until you're done speaking to the patient. When you're with that patient, whether it's for 30 seconds or 5 minutes or however long, you got to be 100% focused on that patient. In your tone, in your physicality, in your body language, in your eye contact, all of it. And the studies will show that if you're not 100% focused on the patient, they feel that it actually affects their medical outcomes, and it definitely affects the way they feel about you as a doctor, which is kind of funny if you think about it, because it has nothing to do with the actual treatment you're getting. It's just about the communication of the treatment.
Yeah. Yeah, Steve, I have a family of doctors, you know, on one side, on the other side, it's more business, but I grew up with considering doctors an authority. I grew up with teachers also in my family, and teachers were an authority. But then when it was time for me to teach, I learned about that difference, exactly those points that you made, where the students want to take that authority in their own hands when, you know, when you kind of have to prove not to just have authority, but something else. So that is what also brings me to the next point, which is what is missing among those people who have that authority? Because in my industry, for example, yeah, I think we do that very well. Authority, you know, right? Having that executive presence, working big companies, small startup companies. But what I'm trying to do for the rest of my career, through the roles that I have, is to add energy, excitement, and character. In fact, I changed that as a tagline on LinkedIn, but I honestly believe it with all of with my personality. And so what is missing, and what is being done on that warmth side, that second part of that awe concept that you have? Like at Mayo Clinic, for example, I've heard that they're doing some things that are different. And
I reference a little bit of this in the book. Again, look, you think about authority, like you said, sometimes authority exists. You don't need to have any more authority, you know. Like at the Mayo Clinic, for example, it's one of the top five hospitals in the world. Right. And so if you go to the Mayo Clinic, you're going there, the brand has been established and it's been consistent for over 100 years now, that you know that if you're seeing a doctor for whatever your particular ailment is, it's going to be one of the best doctors in the field anywhere. So he has that authority, or she has that authority, just walking in the door, right? And so you don't need that white lab coat, because that's kind of even overdoing it a little bit. So the Mayo Clinic made a decision that their doctors are not going to wear those white lab coats anymore, and they're just going to be able to connect with you. So that would lend itself, like you say, to this more idea of more warmth, because the authority already exists. So how do you create warmth? I think it's about you know, creating a little bit of level of vulnerability in yourself, instead of hiding behind that white lab coat uniform. Hey, I am your doctor. You have the problem, and you're coming to me because I'm the expert to solve this, you know, very complicated issue you have. But I'm also a person, and I want to relate to you as a human being, and that's part of your treatment. And I want to understand you, and I want to understand what you think your best treatment options are. And here's what A would do. Here's what B would do. Here's what C would do. And just that idea of trying to understand another person. You know, in healthcare, it's very tricky, as you know, because you have a very vulnerable population of people coming to the doctor in the first place. There's a lot of fear, anxiety, unknown, and often very real problems, sometimes almost and truly intractable.
Yeah.
And so I think what the Mayo Clinic and some of these other hospitals are doing is really trying to understand that warmth is about connection. It's about making another person feel acknowledged in it. We all want to feel acknowledged. We all want to feel like we exist in this world, even if we are the patient and we're desperate for this help of another person or another entity. We still want to feel like we exist. Yeah. So I mean, I even see it like, you know, I think another place that does a fantastic job of it is the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York, which is an orthopedic hospital that I just came out of last week. I had hip surgery. Yeah. The second time in 13 months. And I love my doctor. I think he's an amazing, amazing physician and an equally good person, and, you know, cares about me, cares about my outcome, and isn't just doing it because, I mean, he's doing it because he loves what he does. But he called me like the night of my surgery, the next day, the day after. He, you know, I don't know how he does it. I emailed him on Monday. I didn't feel well. And like within 2 minutes, he wrote me back. 2 minutes. And that's the typical norm of him. His name is Dr. Edwin Sue. And, you know, when he calls me on the phone, he's like, "Hey, Steve, it's Ed." And at first I'm like, "Ed?" And then I realize, okay, it's my surgeon. I was a little bit out of it after surgery. But that's the kind of guy he is. He once the surgery is over and he's calling me back to see how I'm doing, he's just like, "Hey, it's your friend Ed here, just checking in on you." And that made me feel so good about him, frankly, and about how much he cares about me. And I think that's the way that hospital surgery, special surgery exists all across the board. They do an unbelievable job.
Yeah. Healthcare quality, I think, in our country is so dependent on so many different stakeholders, including the payers, the insurance companies that direct physicians in terms of their treatments, and force many patients to change their plans every year, right? So these patients then have this problem of medication reconciliation and the continuum of care. They go through from one hospital to another hospital. They change their doctors, and these doctors don't always have the records readily available. So it's a, you know, and patients have to become much more educated, and physicians also, their time with that they spend with patients has now been shortened. But now we have telehealth now, and we have many progressive hospitals such as the ones and physicians like you mentioned, who are realizing that contact time and that human connection is so important, that patient-doctor relationship. It's something that I feel very passionate about. And one of the big reasons, Steve, why I joined the pharmaceutical company, because pharmaceutical industry, because things that may seem boring to others, like or status quo, which you need to maintain and which are so costly, like safety, patient safety, or medication errors that you want to avoid, are those that I wanted to fill the gap in. Steve, so what kind of transformation have you seen through the people that you've known, through the celebrities, going from somebody who's authority, this authority figure, to then going to somebody who's a little bit warm as well, who connects?
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, the thing is that people, I can even say myself personally, I actually learned a lot over the last 5 years in writing this book. And it's funny because my wife pointed out to me in writing it that I would talk a lot about warmth and body language. And she said, you know, I don't know if you're even aware of this, but you cross your arms all the time when you talk to people. When you're sitting in front of someone, your arms are very, you know, tightly folded, and it just gives people, it turns people off. Right. And she said, and you know, you don't smile a lot. You have a real problem. You don't smile very much. And you know, when I thought about it and I started to really kind of become a little more aware of it, she was 100% right. And it took me probably a year to try to make some significant inroads into those two problems. And I'd say I completely cured my arms folding issue, but I'm only about halfway there with the smiling, partly I just had some very, very deep seated, probably subconscious insecurities about my smile, going back to some dental issues I had as a kid. And not realizing that this could be kind of off-putting to people in terms of connecting with them if you're never smiling. And so it just shows you that you can change things. Another good example in terms of authority, I think I use this in the book, I think it's very powerful, is we have this guy who works for our company, our agency, named Reed Pakula, and he came to us at 23 years old, almost, I guess it was almost 3-4 years ago, and after he started out as an intern, and he came to me after a month or two of working there, and he said, how am I doing? And I said, you're doing great. Everyone likes you. You do a good job. People like you. You'll be promoted and you'll be on the staff soon. And his response shocked me. He said, I don't want to hear that from you. Don't tell me what I'm doing well. I hear how you talk to people. I know the book you're writing. Tell me what I could do better. What's one thing you would change about me? And I said, okay. And I said, you say the word like way too much. It really hurts your authority. You're a nice, bright kid. You work hard. But every sentence, you sound like a valley girl. And he said, okay, fine. And then about 2-3 weeks later, he came back and said, how am I doing? And I said, you're doing terribly. You haven't changed at all. And that gave me the insight to work with him and help myself on this idea of self-awareness is not enough. You have to have some other trigger of your own behavior to change it. And so what we did is I taught him to really notice everybody else in his world saying the word like. That became very annoying to him. And once he started to become annoyed by it with others, he became much more self-aware, and then he was able to really completely change it. He hasn't said that word in years.
Yeah, you've had a huge effect on him. Your comments there made me think about coaching in general and coaches and observation. You know, I often say that the best coaches don't always have to be the best players, but they have that amazing ability to observe the human condition, you know, and there's so many examples like that, you know, mm-hmm. Mourinho, right, Pat Riley, they weren't, let's say, the best as professional players, but they ended up being great at you know, at maximizing their team's potential, their individual's potential as well.
Right.
And in fact, I recently saw a video with Michael Jordan where he was asked, look, why didn't you decide to be a coach? Michael Jordan was the best player, right? But he said, look, I didn't have the patience. I know it requires a lot of patience, and I just knew that I would not be a good coach.
Can I say something about coaching? Because I think it's a really interesting topic. Yeah, this is kind of, I think, a different insight about coaching that I think is true. Maybe your audience will or won't agree. is that, to me, coaching comes back to that same issue that we talked about with the Mayo Clinic or the medical field.
Yeah.
It's ultimately about acknowledgement. I don't think a person can change unless they acknowledge for themselves they have something that needs to be changed. And we're all very defensive people. So you might have a small subset of human beings in the world, like a Tom Brady, whoever, who are used to it as kids. And they might just, okay, you yell at me. I like that. I'm good with it. I don't care what you say about me. I'm going to work on it. I'm going to like subsume my ego when I'm on the field, whatever it might be. But for the most, the rest of us, in most of our lives, if someone comes up to you and says, Tim, you know, you look terrible in white shirts, or, you know, you're not, that sales thing was terrible, and I don't know you, I don't have a standing with you,
right, right.
You're going to be like, who are you? I don't want to hear right. that. So I think ultimately it comes down to the best coaches figure out a way to meet the person on their turf first and mm-hmm. understand what kind of levers need to be pulled to get the most out of the person. And one of my favorite books that I've ever read is called Seabiscuit. It's a very, really amazing historical novel, not a novel, it's a historical nonfiction book about a horse that was a racing champion, you know, almost 100 years ago in the 30s and 40s. And what's amazing about it is how the trainer, Tom Smith, was able to figure out how each of his horses would respond. Some horses, you had to really push them hard to run fast. Others, if you pushed them hard, they wouldn't run at all. And others, if you didn't push them, they wouldn't run at all. And so I think we are like that as people, that we respond to certain, kind of things that, and other people respond to other things. And great coaches figure out which kind of person responds to what and how you can implement that.
Yeah, that's what's challenging to do. And I know you talk about Tom Coughlin in the book, but I don't know how many of those stories you want to give away right now on the podcast. But I'm telling you guys, those who are listening, he has many, many stories that are incredibly just illustrative that will really stimulate you and to capture that awe in other people through authority, warmth, and energy. So I don't know how much you want to talk about Tom Coughlin
topic. Yeah, sure. I mean, listen, I think Tom Coughlin is an amazing story and really an incredible guy that, you know, he was 60 years old, had been a successful, but not really top level coach at that point. And he was coaching the New York Giants football team and they were relatively mediocre. They had lost in the first round of the playoffs and their best player quit, Tiki Barber, because he hated the coach and he quit at the prime of his life. And the team, the owners of the team and others came to him and said, coach, you know, you got to change. If you don't change your overbearing tactics and you're just running the people into the ground, not showing any kind of frankly warmth, for lack of a better word, for others, then we can't have you here anymore. And he said they had an intervention with him and it kind of something must have shifted in his mind almost immediately when that happened. Cause it was his family also said to him, dad, people hate you. You know, what's going on here? And somebody said, well, just treat the players a little bit like the way you treat your kids and grandkids. And the next day he brought his grandkids to practice. He was rolling in the, on the grass with them. And it just opened up a part of his personality that he was afraid to show, a vulnerability and a realness towards his players. And he started telling his players how much he loved them. And this amazing thing happened. That same team that went 8-8 the next year won the Super Bowl. And Tom Coughlin beat the Patriots, what some thought was the greatest team of all time. And then they beat him again a few years later. And he's a two-time Super Bowl winning coach. All because, in my opinion, he went from being all about authority to mixing a lot of warmth in with that authority. And really giving people a real deep sense of who he was. And I think he fell in love with his players in a way that he was able to express that. And his players fell in love with him. And because of that, they played a lot harder. And they obviously played as a cohesive team.
Yeah, what a result there, right? That ended up in that transformation that culminated in a Super Bowl, in a huge success.
Two Super Bowls. By the way, the lesson here for you, I think, if you're listening to this, is if your life isn't going exactly how you want it to go, take a look in the mirror, ask a friend, ask your wife, ask a family member, someone you trust. How's my authority? How's my warmth? How's my energy? And it could be like Tom Coughlin, you're doing fine in life. You know, you could do better. And if you amped up your warmth or your energy or your authority, depending on what you need and the granularity of it, you may find, like Coughlin, like myself, like others, you'll soar to heights that you couldn't even think were possible just because you made those small changes.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for sharing those, Steve. So asking questions, observing. I saw your recent post on LinkedIn, also across social media, right? If you're not able to do it very fast, right? Don't get discouraged, right? Keep observing, right? Is that what you, I think?
Yeah. The more you observe in others, the more you can help observe yourself. I mean, that's ultimately what it's about.
Yeah.
It's being able to make those changes in the moment, in the interactions you're having with people, to recognize if someone is deflated by your energy, to recognize if someone feels like you're not connecting with them, and to be able to make those shifts to create that connection or create that good energy. That's what it's about.
Yeah.
It's not about anything else.
So as we're wrapping up, I have just a couple of questions left. I want to talk about energy management. I think it's so critical today in the kind of world in which we live, because energy is that third, last part of your awe principle. So who are some people that you've met or you've had in your talent management agency who just personify that, you know, that energy?
I mean, there's a lot of people. I would say that a couple names come to mind quickly. One is a guy named Greg Amsinger, who's the lead talent host for a show called MLB Tonight on the MLB Network. And Greg just has this infectious, incredible enthusiasm for what he's doing and also for his life, frankly. You can't be around Greg and not feel a sense of energy. I think he has a tremendous sense of gratitude for his existence on this planet. And it emanates outwardly and inwardly to the outside, that feeling. And, you know, you just want to be around those people who love every meal they're having and feel a sense of gratitude for the food and what goes into it. And just the ability to talk about baseball because he loves it so much. Dick Vitale is another one of our clients who does that, I think, very well, really feels a sense of appreciation and joy for being able to do college basketball. And, you know, I mentioned it earlier, Professor Barry Friedman, who's now at NYU Law School, is another guy. His excitement and enthusiasm for talking about police reform or constitutional law, it's incredible. And it just shows you that there's no subject on earth that can't be exciting and communicated with a level of energy and excitement if you take the time to become curious about it and interested in it and appreciative of what you can learn from it and what you can impart to others. So that, to me, is how you can really create a lot of good energy in your life and energy with others.
Yeah, it's very much internal, right? It's spiritual, right? I mean, I had one mentor, probably one of the biggest mentors in my life, who was a professor for 32 years, my own grandmother. And I remember when she was in her 80s, right? Like even in her 80s, and she just passed away just about a year ago. Even at that age of 88, she had more energy than many other friends that I had that were in their 20s or 30s, just because of the curiosity she had. She used to write down everyone's birthdays in her book, just handwritten notes. And she would remind you to call someone, you know, because she knew how important it was to recognize other people. And so it was just that, but the energy that she had was what she was known by not just her family members, but her friends and things like that. So it's energy is so, so critical and it's memorable. So what, like when you have authority, you get respect, you get that reputation, you have warmth, you get trust from people. So with energy, what is the outcome?
I think the outcome of energy is you get people who want to be around you. And when people want to be around you, they want to follow you. It gets you influence. Uh-huh. If you're either inflating people or you're deflating them. And, you know, I think it's very hard to stay right in the middle there. And if you're making people feel good about themselves and good about the interactions you have with them, they want to be around you. They want to follow you. They want to listen to you. Your ideas get taken more seriously. Yeah. So it gives you that level of influence. So without influence, you got nothing.
Yeah. So one final question that I have, and after that, feel free to share any message you have with the listeners. But the final question that I have is the observation that I've made, where why is it that so many great, talented performers, whether it be singers, street musicians that I've seen personally, or I'm sure you have and many others, why is it that they don't get recognized with those awards if they have those talents? What keeps them from reaching that next level of getting that promotion at work? What is that secret that maybe you can share with our listeners?
Well, I think it's interesting. I think, look, first of all, let's be honest, okay? A lot of life is luck on a lot of levels, okay? You could have 100 people who are great musicians and one person wins the Grammy Award, and then maybe all 99 of them are better than the one.
I agree.
It's just luck. I mean, first of all, there's a genetic component, like how good your voice is. Part of that's genetic. Right. And there's also, just luck of where you were born, your parents, who gave you your first guitar, what school you went to. There's so many variables that are just luck induced.
Yeah.
But with that being said, I do think that one of the worst things I think people could say is, oh, this guy got promoted because he's really good at playing politics. And I just think that I would say that so much of life comes down to luck in terms of why someone gets an award or why one person succeeds to the fullest and another one doesn't. But putting aside luck, I do think people talk about like, well, this one got promoted because he played politics. And I think that's a bit of a cop-out, because ultimately, to me, the people that do well in life are the ones that try to understand another person's perspective. And yeah, there are phonies out there, of course, but not everybody's a phony. And I think people who, acknowledge other people, they work well with others, they're the ones that often are the ones that go to the top. And it's those relationships behind the scenes that you don't see is what propels a lot of people. I've seen it in my own career here, not my career, but in the career of others, that I've now been doing this job for almost 30 years, right? And I see guys like Brian Anderson, who's been a client of mine since 1993 or so. He's now one of the top voices on Turner Sports. 27 years, and people are finally really hearing about him. He's doing very high-level games because for 27 years, he's been an amazing person behind the scenes. Everybody likes the guy. He's very invested in everyone else's success. Same thing with a guy like Dave Revson at the Big Ten Network, who I've also been representing for 25 plus years, and Dan Shulman at ESPN. All these guys are the same. They subsume their egos. They work hard for the product. They get along with their coworkers. And slowly over time, they've all been continuously promoted to higher and higher positions. It's not an accident. And are they the most talented? I don't know. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. I don't know if there's even a way to quantify that. They're all certainly talented, but I would argue that they had enough talent and a lot of the other stuff, and that's why they've been very, very successful at the highest levels.
Yeah, they've been able to develop relationships, right? Yeah,
Because they care about other people. It's not about them.
Yeah, and caring about other people is, I think, a good way we can wrap up our discussion here, because you have been able to create many other leaders. And creating other leaders is what I'm dedicating all the All Out Coach podcast, which I mentioned is not mine, it's our podcast, is your podcast, those who are listening. What is your greatest accomplishment? I'd like to finish with that, because I ask that to my guests.
I would challenge one thing. My greatest accomplishment is the pride that I have, not just in representing all these successful people that have gone on to great things in the media career.
Yeah.
I would say it's really more about, I probably have, 15 or 20 people that used to work for me in some capacity, whether intern or otherwise, that have just gone incredibly successful in the business world. And not just professionally, they have done well with their families and in their communities. One of my former guys is now the vice chairman of Newmark Realty. And another guy was a top executive at the Miami Dolphins. Now he's in the drone racing league. Another guy was big time at CAA and started his own agency recently. I'm still in touch with all these people, and I'm so proud of them for who they've become. But I would challenge one thing. I didn't make them great leaders. They became great leaders. I helped along the way a little bit, I'm sure, but they become great leaders. And all the people that work at our agency now, I've seen so many of the young agents that we've had just blossom into amazing people, amazing leaders. And that makes me so happy. I sort of look at my life like, when my time on earth is done, I think what I'll be most proud of is this tree that I left behind professionally in terms of all the people who did well and all the people that they have working for them now and now how they've paid it forward. So I think I've tried to create this like cultural thing that exists outside the four walls of my company. and exist in this netherworld where it's just this good aura and karma that's perpetuating in all the entities that all these people are working at. So that's my hope, and I think I'll, you know, achieve some of that.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. This comes across, your fulfillment, personal fulfillment comes across, and your passion for what you do, for helping. Yeah, it's absolutely. And I think the listeners will hear that, and we'll see it on the YouTube channel as well. Get the book, Don't Take Yes for an Answer. Any final comments you have about not taking yes for an answer or anything else you'd like, Steve?
I just say, you know, like I said, I closed the book by saying, I quote the rapper Chuck D, don't believe the hype. We all need to do better. This is something that we can all be better at in our lives, myself included, hopefully to the last day on earth for all of us. And, you know, just don't believe the hype. Just even if you are great, you can even be greater, and try to always be improving and figuring out things you can improve upon. And I think you'll have, not only will you have greater success in your life, I truly believe you'll be happier. I see that people that strive for betterment, to me, it's a sign of fulfillment and happiness too. So read the book, please. And if not, go on my Instagram, you know, SteveHurst66.
Thanks, Steve. You're invited to be my guest on All Out Coach on your next book that you write, or any project or any reason.
And thank you, Tim. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Have a great day. Good to talk to you, buddy.
Thank you. Thank you too. You too, Steve.